At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
At Arizona State University, we're bringing world-class education from our globally acclaimed faculty to you. Earn your degree from the nation's most innovative university, online. That's a degree better. Learn more at asuonline.asu.edu.
Didn't we almost have it all in defense of Whitney Houston is a candid exploration of the genius, shame and celebrity of Whitney Houston a decade after her passing. The world has mourned her death amid new revelations about her relationship to her blackness, her sexuality and her addictions. Didn't we almost have it all is author of Garrett Kennedy's exploration of the duality of Whitney's life as both a woman in the spotlight and someone who also had to hide from who she was, or indeed hide who she was. Delighted to be joining me live on the line, author of Didn't We Almost Have It All, Garrett Kennedy. Garrett, good morning, good afternoon to you.
Good morning for me here. Thank you so much.
Whereabouts are you, by the way? I didn't ask you.
I'm in Los Angeles.
Very nice indeed, too. We kind of think, as we always do with our pop stars, that we know them and we have a relationship with them. And I remember I was probably about 16, 17 when Whitney Houston sprang onto the scene with I Want to Dance with Somebody. And she seemed the embodiment of, you know, good health 80s. She was the American dream, but it's a dream that gets very, very dark.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's the thing, though, with Whitney is so much of what we believed that we knew, we understood, is what we then allowed us to use to then judge her, right? You know, because we believe that it was Bobby Brown who introduced a lot of this darkness to her life, and you know, everything was perfect before him. You know, these are things that we sort of just assumed, and so I wanted to write. I wanted to write a book exploring not just how we projected our own expectations onto her, but also our own shame when we started to learn things about Whitney that went against the image, right? Went against the all-American, the image. That's when we started to really project our own shame onto her, but also sort of ridicule her. That's when we started to criticize her a lot more deeply than before, where it was just, oh, well, maybe this music isn't what we thought that, you know, a black woman from Newark should be singing. It started to turn into something else over time.
And because, you know, she had lineage. I mean, if correct me if I'm wrong, her aunt was Dionne Warwick. Am I correct in that one? I seem to remember that one.
Cousin,
thank you. See, that's why you're the author and I'm not, but thank you. But, you know, so people just assume that she's going to walk onto the stage, be brilliant. But, you know, nobody is a two-dimensional human being. And she was obviously more than that. And she didn't, you know, not everybody can take to stardom effortlessly. And, you know, Whitney was the biggest star in the world. I mean, Madonna notwithstanding.
Right. And that's something, too, that I think was really important to explore. You know, she was the biggest star in the world, but there had never been a black woman that had done any of the things that Whitney had done. There also hadn't been really many people who had done all the things that Whitney had done, right? But to have a conversation about Whitney's fame, what she meant to the world, what she was able to accomplish, the barriers that she broke, we have to have a conversation about race, and we have to have a conversation about how race impacted her, because so much of her story was her running from this idea that we put onto her that she wasn't black enough.
But, I mean, that's right. We'll get to the cruxes immediately, because this is one of the things, isn't it? If you look at some of the artists who become big, think of Prince at the time, you know, light-skinned. You think of the current thing going on, you know, with Beyonce. She's been called out for not being black enough, if you like. But Whitney was at the front of this, wasn't she? I mean, she was that projection of the American woman, but she was a light-skinned black woman.
Yeah, and you know, but this idea, you know, it wasn't based in colorism. It was based in the fact that she was a woman from Newark. We knew she was from the hood. We knew she had these gospel roots. So why wasn't she singing music in a particular kind of style, right? So we started to then do this thing of, well, it's because it's not, you know, it doesn't have the sensuality of Anita Baker, because she doesn't have the electricity of Tina Turner, the music's not black enough, you know? And so because the music didn't feel black enough to people, then they said that she was not black enough. And, you know, what became so interesting about that idea is, you know, years down the road, as she is stopping code switching, as she is getting more frustrated with the press, and she is just showing us, you know, Nippy, which again was that woman from Newark, we then started to say, oh, you're a little too black. You're now you're a little ghetto, you know? And I think when you think about duality and you think of the way in which, you know, this conversation about race and how people saw her blackness and how that was judged and criticized and ridiculed and how it shifted. But it was a lifelong conversation around her, which, you know, we would never do to any artist now, but that's what we did to Whitney.
I mean, how much input did she have on the tracks that she puts out, though? I mean, she's young when she becomes a star. A worldwide star very quickly.
Yeah, I mean, that's the sort of the assumption that she never picked any of the music because she wasn't a writer and she wasn't a producer in a traditional sense. But no one ever took the time to, one, acknowledge the fact that every song that we heard of hers, yes, one, she was choosing the songs, but if she didn't like the song, she didn't sing the song. But secondly, how all of these songs were sang, that's a decision she made. The notes and the way that she carries her notes, that's a decision she made. So that's vocal producing, which I think people have an understanding of what that is now. But in the late 80s, early 90s, we didn't. All we saw was, well, you didn't write these songs and you didn't make the beats. So therefore, you don't have any real autonomy over your own music. You can't possibly then, right? If this is all somebody else is doing, then you can't be the one in charge of anything. And I think that's really unfortunate because it took away from some of the brilliance of who she was as an artist.
How much backup did she have? I mean, we all know sort of Beyonce and that whole sort of, you know, factory kind of, the, you know, has the father looking after and manufacturing and looking after them. Did she have a team, Whitney? Was there a team Houston?
Well, of course there was a team. I mean, every artist has a team.
Yeah.
And I think what was, you know, really unfortunate with her treatment in particular was, you know, a key person on her team, you know, was Robin Crawford, a friend of hers who, you know, yes, they had maybe had a romantic fling when they were 18, you know, but that was not something that we needed to then focus on for 20 years and also invalidate a woman's contributions to, so, you know, her friend's career. And that's what we did. And that's, you know, one of the things that I have had the biggest issues with is just this way that, you know, Robin was dismissed, you know, culturally, because that she was seen as, oh, well, that's just the assistant. And, you know, she's on payroll because, you know, they're hiding this relationship. And it's no, they built the Whitney Houston brand together. And that is so powerful, but that got so lost in our obsession with the gossip, our obsession with her sexuality, our obsession with this idea that she's hiding something from us. And we almost, to the point, we terrorized her for it for so many years.
I mean, and
this, if we're being honest.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the things, because we live in a world now where, you know, everybody's got an Instagram, everybody's on social media. So you kind of, you're supposed to be able to see into the lives of your idols or what they let you see them. I mean, how it's only 40 years ago, but you couldn't have a same-sex relationship and be out in the open and be a worldwide star.
No, and you know, and also the other thing too that we have to also remember is someone who was a teenager who could have very well just been experimenting, like a lot of us have, and we've had the privacy and we've had the privilege of being able to have that moment, and whatever it means for us, it means for us. It doesn't then become a storyline for years and years and years and years, to the point where, you know, I'm now a month after this book has been out, and I've half of the interviews, they only want to ask about Robin. And it's just like, I don't actually even understand what is that interesting about it. If we're going to be really honest about it, right? Like, it's not that fascinating that an 18-year-old woman had a same-sex relationship with her friend, you know, as a teenager. It is not at all compelling. And I know maybe some of that is because I am queer, but also that's my own reflection on, I have been the one with some of my straight friends who they wanted to try something. And none of that is actually groundbreaking, right? But it became this thing because, again, when we're thinking about coverage of celebrities and particularly pop artists in the late 80s and early 90s, there was a fascination around sex in a particular kind of way. But because this was something that was still seemed so taboo, we needed to have an answer. And because there was no answer, she was met with so much violence. You know, that's why I used the word violence in the book, because there was a level of aggression that she was met with from reporters and critics and radio hosts, where it was, why aren't you telling us who you're sleeping with? Why? You must be hiding something. Something must be going on. What about this woman? Why? You know, it was this way that there was so many questions around it. Mostly, yes, some of it is because at the time that we were in, we didn't really truly have these real conversations around sexuality that was not steeped in some level of shame.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because if you flip that around and you've got Madonna at the same time, and she's got the book Sex out, and that's you know, setting the world alight.
Yeah, but it's different because Madonna's showing her body, and when it comes to women, we love that and we want that. And so because she was giving that to us, we then were satisfied. But because Whitney was beautiful and she wasn't showing us her body, we needed to have these other questions of, well, who are you sleeping with? Because that creates the image for us in our head. If we at least know who you're sleeping with, then we can feel better about you not sleeping with us, because we don't have a chance with you. But if we don't have access to your body, then because of that, we then need to have some level of access to what is happening in your life. And you can really see a real correlation with how she was treated versus a Madonna or versus a Janet Jackson or versus a Paula Abdul, you know, all these women that she came up with at the same time, but women whose image were a little bit more sexually forward, right? Because we were at least had some level of connection to their bodies in that way, we weren't as aggressive with them as it came to, well, who are you having sex with? Because it didn't matter, because we were at least fantasizing about having sex with them. Well, we couldn't do that with Whitney because she stood there in dresses. And, you know, she was not really, really, really over the top, you know, sexy. And there's nothing wrong with that, but we punished her for it. And then we also thought, well, maybe you're hiding something. And once there was some trickle of a rumor that there had been something when she was, you know, a young woman in Newark before she was famous to the public, that was something that people ran with for a long time.
And then we get to, you know, the shock horror Bobby Brown, you know, as if he, you know, the pantomime villain of this whole piece, as the media would have us believe.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, one of the things that I wanted to do in the book that, you know, has been really interesting to talk to people is challenging their perceptions around that. And I also, you know, I really do mean it when I say, if Bobby wasn't a black man, he wouldn't have been treated the way that he was. We also wouldn't have assumed he was doing all of the things to Whitney, right? If she had not gone with somebody who was adjacent to hip hop, we would have then but not been able to say, oh, well, of course, you know, there's drugs. Oh, well, of course, you know, he's rough around the edges, and all these things that we did, and we judged him based off, even though they both had similar upbringings, you know, they both came from, you know, hard parts of the world where it was challenging to be black folks, because we were around a lot of violence. We were around, you know, a lot of drugs. We were around a lot of, you know, really hard living. And I think because of that, it was so easy for people to then look at him and say, he's the problem, because he had issues, right? Because he had run-ins with the law, because he had, you know, kids with several different women. There was a way that it was easy for folks to then just sort of do the thing of passing him off as the issue. But also so much of that was rooted in the fact of, this is how we see black men, especially in the early 90s. And I wanted us to have a real conversation around that, because even now I see so much of, you know, I've talked to so many people and they're like, yeah, you know, when she went and got with that little rapper, and I'm like, well, he wasn't a rapper. He was in one of the biggest R&B groups of all time. And the fact that you dismiss him that casually lets me know everything I need to know about how you saw him and how you still see him to this day.
But that's, I mean, that's, that is to do with us and what we bring to the table, isn't it? If you see somebody yeah. like that, you go, okay, well, I know your backstory already. I know you, you know, you're bad to your woman. I know you've got lots of, you know, baby mama, you know, you've got lots of babies around the place and, you know, you've got tattoos, you're no good. And it's that way that we, you know, we impose our, you know, our own problems or our own prejudices on people we don't even know.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, that's sort of a tale as old as time as it relates to celebrity, which is a big part of, you know, what I wanted to explore. So much of the book isn't, you know, just the straight ahead story about her life. It's also our relationship to not just Whitney, but our relationship to fame, our relationship to sexuality, our relationship to blackness in America, what all of that looked like for a person who was the most famous women on the planet. And the reality is, you know, part of what this book is, you know, it's a reflection of how far we've come. You know, so much of what we see now and how we talk about celebrity, how we talk about addiction and mental health and sexuality and blackness and all of these things that impacted Whitney and impacted her career and our relationship to both of those have radically changed. You know, we're seeing it right now in the conversations we're having around Janet Jackson and the conversations we're having around Britney Spears, this conversation we're trying to have around Kanye West right now. You know, we have shifted a lot of our thoughts and attitudes culturally, but yes, I wanted to write to that, but I also wanted to write a reflection of we weren't always, you know, trying. You know, we weren't always making the effort that we do now of trying to have a clear understanding that's not rooted so much in judgment or ridicule, but is rooted in us just trying to understand the complexities of an artist and of, you know, just the natural human conscience in mind. But we didn't do that then. And unfortunately, Whitney was a victim of those circumstances.
And the thing is, you know, with the addictions and stuff, I mean, it's been said time and time again that, you know, it's the hole in the soul. You're trying to plug it. You're trying to get rid of reality. And here was a person who maybe had a right to want to block out reality. And also, you know, mental health issues weren't even discussed, you know, 40, you know, 30 years ago or even 20 years ago. It was just get on stage and sing your heart out. And perhaps that's what we saw.
Yeah, and you know, and the other thing too that I thought was, you know, really important to reflect on is, you know, we had, you know, by the time we had real conversations with Whitney about what was going on, it was after, you know, our suspicions and, you know, her denials, and then eventually those denials became impossible to keep up with. And so then the conversation had to come into a level of admission. And of course, you know, you think of a moment like Diane Sawyer and, you know, this whole crack is whack and how that has become sort of this infamous line. But what I found about all of that time that I thought was so interesting to explore was the fact that you had, you know, both Whitney and Bobby, they were not doing anything that a lot of musicians were not doing. But there was a moment that I write this in the book where I'm like, but they also forgot that they were black people in America, and black people in America aren't allowed to get high. Not like white people. You just aren't. If you can go name me, if you can go name me right now, a dozen plus rock stars who have been revered for their drug use, who are celebrated for their drug use, who would never face the amount of criticism for their drug use, go name me the same amount of black artists and you won't be able to count on even one hand. And that's something that I needed us to say really clearly. And people still push back against that because they don't want to have the conversation around race as it relates to drugs. But I'm like, you have to, because it's also tied into the coverage. It's tied into how we looked at what the drugs, what people on Wall Street were doing versus what people in South LA were doing. And it was the exact same drug. However, we saw these wealthy white folks on Wall Street, and it was, okay, it's a party drug, but then when it's in the hood, it's, oh my God, you know, it's a tragedy. It's, let's send tanks in and let's do, you know, it became a very different treatment. And I always thought, you know, if anything else where Whitney and Bobby failed themselves were forgetting, yes, we are wealthy. You are, of course, but you're still black people in this country and you're not allowed to get high. And that's just how it's always been. And And if I'm wrong in that, I want people to then bring me the proof of major celebrities who have been black, who we have allowed to talk about their drug use, and we not judge it, and we not criticize it, and we not demean it. And so I wanted to have that conversation too, as much as, yes, they were making decisions around being, you know, using, of course, but also if you are famous and you are using and you're seeing how this is the culture of this industry, well, I don't know why I'm being treated differently. And I needed to sit with that, because that was the reality of what they believed.
And it's very interesting, isn't it? Because everybody goes, oh yeah, Keith Richards, amazing. Or we have, you know, the recovery story, and it's always normally a white male, you know, Robert Downey Jr.'s or whatever. And it's an amazing accomplishment. You know, they came back from the brink and they're lauded, and rightly too. But yeah, we don't look at our musicians of color and go, oh, well, he's a party animal. They just go, this is a frightening thing. This goes back to what we've been fed a narrative for. Well, we can go back a long, long way with that.
Yeah. And even with the Robert Downey Jr., we don't then every time he sits down to an interview, talk about the drugs. Well, tell us again what was going on. We don't do that. You know, we let it go. But we did it. Even when Whitney had moments of, you know, being sober, she still then had to go and sit, and then somebody's going to ask her a question. Somebody's going to keep asking. So, you know, I think a lot about the unkindness that she faced from the public and also the media. And while, again, none of these things, you know, to me, killed her, because a person still made a decision, right? When you think of the destruction of a person, we contribute it greatly. And there's no way that we can say that we cannot. And that's something that, you know, I also wanted this book to show. You know, that's not the entirety of the book. Of course, the book is very much a celebration of who she was, but also who she wasn't and who she wasn't allowed to be by us. And I wanted it. It was important for me to have conversations like that. Like, we were a part of this. And I think so much we're able to, especially now in this era of social media, we're able to detach ourselves, where we don't realize, well, actually, we do have some power, you know, with these people, because not only are we buying their music, buying tickets to their shows, to their movies and all this other stuff, we are consuming them as people. And that's something that I think that we don't always really recognize the potential dangers of, that when we are so callous in the way that we talk about people online, and realize that, you know, they're still people and they probably are going to read this. And I know that they have all the money in the world and they shouldn't care, but you can't tell a person to not care about what people are saying about them on the internet. That just does not actually work. You know,
I mean, people will come back and go, and I hear it all the time, people saying, oh yeah, but you know, they're public figures, so that, you know, they're used to it. But at the end of the day, they're not.
It's true. But it's still like human nature too. I think it feels good for people to look at, you know, rich, you know, famous, beautiful people, and we like to see them fail. We like to see them get taken down a peg. But then we also love to see them have a comeback. You know, it's sort of this sick thing, right, where it becomes the cycle that we also feed into, because it's part of a story, because it allows us to escape our own lives, which, you know, I think about that a lot, because, you know, especially right now we're seeing, you know, with Kanye and Kim, and just the way that, you know, there is something really insidious happening with the way that this man has been abusing this woman on social media. And we just are looking at it as entertainment. We're looking at it as, oh, you know, Kim can handle it, you know, because she's famous, right? Because, you know, she had the show and she's got all the Instagram followers. So she can handle this. But it's also just like, I mean, at the same time, sure, she can shut it off, but like, I'm sure she is seeing the death threats. I'm sure she has seen all this. I'm sure it is unpleasant for her to log onto her Instagram right now. So it doesn't change the fact that even though there's all this money and all this stuff, it doesn't change that what we're doing to people is abusive.
But that's the nature of celebrity in a social media age, because you've got people sitting in their basements in some corner of the world just throwing abuse, because even your, I mean, you know, in the 60s, you could step away if you could, you know, get away from the reporters. But now, obviously, social media, you can see what comes up, and people think they have an investment in these people, and they don't realize when the show stops and the real life begins.
Right. Yeah. And but that's also tied to, I think, our entitlement around it. You know, we truly believe that we are, you know, owed these things from these people, and we're not. We're not at all. We're not owed anything. You know, we're not owed anything.
When it comes to writing this book, and it's 10 years, and you sat down with the blank page or the blank computer screen, how do you go about it? I mean, how do you think, right, I'm going to properly do this?
I spent years researching. There's also, you know, a lot of it is powered by the fact that she's an artist, you know, that I've loved my entire life. So it was really, I don't want to say easy, but it was at least easy in terms of, you know, I wanted to write about the ways in which I think about her and the ways in which I talk about her and these conversations that I like to have, you know, when she comes up or when people, or when they'll ask me about, you know, the weekend of her passing, you know, because I was there. And, you know, I like to focus on, you know, the other parts. I like to focus on, you know, well, these are the moments in the music that I thought were interesting, but also, like, I wanted to write about her lineage. I wanted to write about the impact of Sissy Houston, because I think so many people have just dismissed, you know, Sissy as, they'll say it as, you know, gospel legend and, oh, she's staying with Aretha, you know, Whitney's mom. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But, like, I wanted to take that step back and it's like, no, let's really go to the beginning, you know, with Sissy and her contributions, because her contributions have been so formidable to how we understand contemporary gospel music and contemporary soul music. And that was really important when you then think about what is then passed on to her child. So, you know, yes, I'm staring at a blank screen, but I also have so many notes all over the place, but I operate, you know, the same way as I do if I'm writing just, you know, a small feature for a publication. You know, I know the story that I want to tell. I know the sources I want to use. I know how to organize it. A lot of what I was up against with this, you know, particular book was, you know, we were in lockdown. You know, we had this pandemic that was obviously life-changing, and in the moment I couldn't really think about it because I was just focused on this book. I decided to focus on this book. I mean, I couldn't leave the house anyways, but, you know, I was focused on writing this, and so I was able to escape what was happening in the world by writing. And so that became really powerful, and it also became therapy in a sense too, because the world was very grim. It still is, right?
Absolutely. So talking about escaping, sounds like somebody with four legs is trying to escape or to get you to take them out for a walk. I can hear them in the background.
yes.
The book is called Didn't We Almost Have It All? I'm going to run out of time. In Defense of Whitney Houston, it's by Derek Kennedy. If people want to find more information about you or about the book, where can they find you?
They can go to GarrettKennedy.net. I'm also at Garrett Kennedy on Twitter and Instagram.
Gary Kennedy, author of Didn't Have Almost Have It All, fascinating, In Defense of Whitney Houston. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Warm season's greetings to you all.